From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. There could be another high-profile hearing on Capitol Hill this week, or maybe not. The House Judiciary Committee wants to question Attorney General Bill Barr on Thursday for the first time since the release of the redacted Mueller report, but the Department of Justice has taken issue with the format that the House has proposed. Let's get more now from NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Hi, Danielle.
Hey there.
So Democrats have been trying to force Barr to testify for a while now. What's the latest on these negotiations?
Right. So just to back up and to make things clear here, Barr is scheduled to testify Wednesday before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Now, that committee is separate from what we're talking about here, but just to make sure there's no confusion.
It's also controlled by Republicans as opposed to the House committee, which is controlled by the Democrats.
Absolutely, yes. So there are some disputes between Barr and those Democrats who control the House who really want to push him on the Mueller report. There are a couple parts of that dispute. One is over whether committee staff and lawyers get to question Barr. Those committee lawyers, I am told, can be pretty skilled in their questioning, knowledgeable about the nitty-gritty of what they're getting into. And also, aside from that, there is a dispute over whether there will be a closed-door questioning of Barr over the redacted portions of that report. Now, there are a lot of reports out there. There are various news reports that suggest that Barr has threatened to skip the hearing, but thus far, as far as we know, nothing has been decided. The hearing is still scheduled for Thursday morning, but those back and forth seem to still be going on.
And by the way, there's so far threat of a subpoena, but there's no subpoena yet for Barr.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, we will keep watching that and see whether it's going to be a fiery day on Capitol Hill this Thursday in the House. But while we wait, Danielle, we're also watching the 2020 race as it changes each week. We seem to get a new candidate. And the big talk the last couple of days has been about Joe Biden, the former vice president. He's having his first rally in Pittsburgh today. First of all, tell us more about why he chose that location for the first one.
Right. I mean, it doesn't seem immediately necessarily obvious. It's not Iowa and it's not New Hampshire. But, you know, Pennsylvania is his home state. And aside from that, you know, if you look at what he is saying and where he's going, he's making this middle class argument, his campaign has said, about making an economy that works for everyone. He's doing it at a Teamsters hall. So it's a message about labor. And this is a city with a strong labor presence, a city with a strong steelworker presence. A segment of the economy, manufacturing, that used to be much stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one big part of it. Aside from that, you know, he opened his campaign on a fighting Trump note. That opening campaign video, he really sort of frames Trump as an existential threat to American democracy. So he's going to the state that Trump won, that he wants to win back and that he thinks he can. Now, aside from that, after this, he'll be heading to Iowa and South Carolina, Nevada. So he is going to do the regular early state trip after this.
Well, but to that point about making this about him versus Trump, I think one of the things that he may have hit on here is that a lot of Democrats would probably vote for any of these candidates. They just want to beat Trump. And he's trying to make the case of saying, I'm the one who can beat Trump. I don't know if I could beat any of these other people in the primary, but I could beat Trump.
Yeah, I mean, he really does seem to be making that electability argument, right? Coming straight out the gate and saying, and really taking the fight to Trump. Now, he has hit the ground at a dead sprint. I mean, if you look at a lot of the polls, he is leading in a lot of the mm-hmm. polls, barely into this race. And in a 20-person field, that's not nothing. Aside from that, you know, 24 hours into opening his campaign, he had around $6 million raised, which mm-hmm. is more than some of his opponents raised in a quarter. So he does have some wind at his back. That said, he does have a long history in Washington, which means accomplishments, but also what his opponents see as some blemishes, some bills that he has voted for, the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings. So he has a lot of, which means his opponents will have a lot of ammo that, in their opinion, to sort of throw at him.
Okay, so one more thing here. One of his opponents is Beto O'Rourke, who released a $5 trillion climate change plan today. Tell us what is in there.
Sure. So like you said, $5 trillion. It's not entirely specific on exactly how that would be paid for, which is a big question mark. He has said, you know, structural changes to the tax code is his phrase, which would mean, you know, corporations, higher income people, fossil fuel companies paying their fair share, as he puts it. But he has said, you know, he wants to get back into the Paris deal. He wants to invest in infrastructure. And there's a part of it that's also a lot like the Green New Deal you've heard a lot about mm-hmm. in terms of environmental justice, making sure that lower income communities are included in whatever happened in this particular mm-hmm. plan.
That is NPR political reporter Danielle Kurtzleben. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now politics in Ukraine, where a president-elect is going from the small screen to the world stage. Volodymyr Zelensky, known for playing a school teacher turned president in a hit Ukrainian TV show, recently won by a landslide in the runoff election against incumbent Petro Poroshenko. Zelensky promised to root out corruption, but now that he's set to take office, the big question is how will he govern without any political experience or clear policy? Here to tell us more is Melinda Herring. She's an expert on Ukraine at the Atlantic Council in Washington, D.C. Melinda, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be with you.
Good to have you. And apparently, Ukrainians were not concerned that they elected an actor to be their next president, a political neophyte in every sense except on TV. Is he up for the job?
That's still an open question. So Volodymyr Zelensky crushed incumbent Petro Poroshenko by almost 50 points. It was a huge victory for Zelensky. But it's wrong to say that voters are super enthusiastic about this political neophyte. People were really in a bad mood, and it was a referendum on Petro Poroshenko and his last 5 years in office.
And a referendum on corruption. What will Zelensky do about that?
So Poroshenko's slogan 5 years ago was living in a new way, and he pivoted massively, and he didn't address people's concerns about corruption. Zelensky made fighting corruption a big part of his campaign. We don't know. Again, Zelensky has links to a notorious oligarch named Ihor Kolomoisky, and those links are really opaque, and we're still waiting to see how strong that relationship is, and we're not going to know immediately. We'll know in the next coming weeks based on some of the appointments he makes and some of the decisions that Zelensky makes once he's inaugurated, how strong those links are. But in general, Zelensky has made a lot of good statements, but he's never held office. He's only been a school teacher on TV, and he doesn't seem to have any discernible views. So this is all an open question. He has appointed two people with strong anti-corruption credentials, and they're both very, very strong on economic development and fighting corruption. So those are at least two good signs in his favor.
Okay, so here you have a man taking this tremendous job with very little experience, but he has just huge problems ahead of him. Look, the country is at odds with a superpower, with Russia, over the 2014 annexation of Crimea. I mean, has he staked out a position on that?
On foreign policy, he's very weak, and he doesn't have any experience, and he doesn't seem to have very good advisors. We're all waiting for him to name some advisors that people in the West recognize, but so far, it doesn't look very satisfying. He does stake out a pro-Western orientation, though. His foreign policy is unlikely to be very different than Petro Poroshenko's foreign policy. He's going to support NATO membership. He supports EU membership. He has said some things, though, that are a little troubling. He called for a referendum on NATO, and I'm not exactly sure why he did that, because the country, if you look at the public opinion polling, Ukrainians support NATO membership by a majority, and that changed after the 2014 Euromaidan revolution. 13,000 people have died, and the country has made its decision. It wants to be part of the West, not part of Russia or any kind of Russian sphere of influence. I think it was an attempt, though, to woo voters in the South and the East. But in reality, once he's president, I think public opinion will constrain him.
If I'm Vladimir Putin, I'm licking my chops here. Is Zelensky totally outmatched?
Look, Putin's been in office since 99, and he's experienced, but he's not brilliant. So Zelensky just needs to hold the line. He needs to not fall for Putin's games and gimmicks. Putin is going to try to tempt him over and over again. They're going to try to give him all kinds of offers that he can't refuse. They're already trying now. The Russians have talked about giving Russian passports to people in the Donbass.
One of the disputed territories there.
Yes, yes. Right. In Luhansk, in Donetsk Oblast, the two disputed territories. That's right.
So what are Western countries thinking, like the United States and the rest of Europe, for that matter, who have an interest in keeping Russia at bay?
I think the West sees Zelensky as an opportunity. There's a lot of questions about him, but his instincts seem to be good so far. And Western ambassadors, foreign ministers are already reaching out to him and talking to him and seeing if they can influence his views. You know, it's too soon to say that he's going to get schooled by Putin. I think that that's too pessimistic of a view.
There's one other thing I want to ask you about. Zelensky will be Ukraine's first Jewish president, and if the prime minister keeps his job, Ukraine will be the only country other than Israel to have Jewish heads of state and government. Is that worth noting to you?
That's absolutely worth noting. So even if the prime minister loses his spot in October, there will be overlap, and Ukraine will have a Jewish prime minister and president at the same time this year. Hmm. And Ukraine has had a traumatic 20th century, right? Ukraine is known for pogroms and anti-Semitism, but that is not the way that modern Ukraine works. If you look at the new Pew opinion polling, Ukrainians, of all of Europeans, are most willing to accept Jews as neighbors. And there are no barriers for Jews to go into public life, high positions of business, academia. That's all changed.
Has a large Jewish population.
Ukraine has the third or fourth largest Jewish population in the world.
That's Melinda Herring, an expert on Ukraine at the Atlantic Council. Melinda, very interesting. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Peter. My pleasure.
If you've ever been hiking in the backcountry of Montana or Wyoming, you might understand what it feels like to be in the presence of a grizzly bear. Even if you never see one, the mere thought can be enough to raise the hair on your neck. Bryce Andrews understands this well. His new book, Down from the Mountain, recalls a summer working at the edge of grizzly habitat for a conservation group in Montana's Mission Valley. His job was to keep a group of hungry bears out of a farmer's cornfield, and the collision between humans and grizzlies did not end well for the animals. Bryce Andrews joins us now. And Bryce, you live and work in the Mission Valley area of Montana. The population of bears around there is different from the bears that live not too far away in Yellowstone National Park, right?
That's correct. And these ones live in and among the farmers and other residents of the valley, which makes their lives very complicated.
And how has the population changed over the years?
Over the course of the 20th century, there was actually a concerted effort on the part of the federal government and state governments to trap and eradicate large predators like the grizzly. There was sort of a low point for the population in the 1970s, and then the Endangered Species Act was used to protect the species, and that's led to this slow but rather steady recovery of the species, which is leading us up to the present moment where we have about 1,800, 1,850 as a minimum count of bears in the northern population, and we're looking at this moment where they can actually begin to expand again into other parts of their historic range.
The way you describe the Mission Valley is incredibly vivid, and I was hoping you could read a passage for me. Do you have the book with you?
I do, yes.
Great. I'd love it if you could read the section where you describe this place in August, and the bears are feeding on the fruit trees that are dangerously close to civilization. It's on page 91.
Plums swelled and softened. The grizzlies knocked hot-fleshed fruit to the ground. They sucked hard at the teats of summer, eating until their guts succumbed. Apples ripened everywhere, bitterroot Macintoshes on leggy, untended trees, prized honeycrisps in orchards, crabapples on the banks of creeks and sloughs, and the feast became frenzy. The grizzlies fed in a series of massive inhalations, taking food the way a skin diver breathes before ducking beneath the waves. This was the rule of August. During the day, the valley belonged to humans. Tractors worked the fields, and children played carefree in the yards. People swam in shady eddies and picnicked beside the creeks. Life, even at the edge of the woods, went on as if ravenous creatures were not hiding among the trees.
It feels a little ominous, that tension between the animals and human beings. How did people deal with that there?
Well, I think different people deal with it in different ways. Certainly the people who are raising some of these crops like corn that grizzlies have learned to feed on, the tension exists for them not just as a philosophical feeling but as a daily reality where they're losing crops. They're having the thin margin of modern agriculture whittled away by these wild animals on the landscape. Other people are shockingly unaware. I mean, I did a series of events in the Mission Valley and in bear country, and there are people, you know, we can look at collar data and see that these bears are in someone's backyard. And then you talk to them and they say to you, I had no idea that grizzlies were in this area. Mm. So there's a tension, but there's also a very real need to make people aware.
And your job one summer is to keep the bears out of this farmer's cornfield by building a fence around it, an electric fence.
Yeah, I mean, It's the kind of place where you really wouldn't expect to see a grizzly bear. But in this case, the cornfield provides, unfortunately, this almost irresistible source of late-season food for the bears.
They love it.
They love it, but it's very bad for them because at a time when they should be up in the peaks feeding on these big colonies of insects that actually nest in the high mission range, they're instead down on the valley floor eating this carbohydrate-rich, fairly unhealthy crop that puts them in conflict with people.
And the fence kind of worked, and it also kind of didn't, right? I mean, like, why didn't that fence, the shock of it, keep those bears out of the cornfield?
There are a lot of reasons for that, and I think probably the primary one has to do with the individuality and inventiveness of these animals. They were looking for every single way in or out of this cornfield because they were so used to having it for about a decade. So, for instance, an irrigation ditch would go dry one night. They would slip under in that muddy canal and get into the field just like that. I think the other part of it has to do with, as I mentioned before, the razor-thin margins of modern agriculture. So the corn farmer who was raising this crop, he doesn't have the time or the resources to commit to maintaining the fence, which makes it very hard to make it a perfect solution.
So over the course of the summer, you're building this fence. You also discover that someone in the area has shot one of these bears. Her name is Millie, and you become almost haunted by what happened to this animal. Can you explain how her fate became mixed up with the humans in the Mission Valley?
It boils down to the placement of this cornfield and the draw of the crop. So just above the cornfield in the foothills of the Mission Range is a place called Millie's Woods. It's the grove that this particular bear is named after. That grove is some of the densest occupied grizzly habitat in the lower 48. So it's a natural place for bears to congregate. And from that location, you can actually see into this cornfield. So it's a very natural progression to come to the edge of the foothills that way. And this cornfield was providing a perfect kind of gateway drug to being comfortable around humans, which was eventually her unmaking.
And you knew she was injured because there were game cameras around this fence in the cornfield. But the fascinating thing about this book is that you didn't actually come across Millie or any bear, really, in this book until it was almost over. But I got the sense that you kind of wanted to, that you almost tempted fate a few times, walking into the cornfield without much protection. You knew there were bears inside, but it felt like that they were drawing you in.
Certainly. And I can't fully explain or entirely defend that because there were moments when I look back on them, these were the times when like my grandmother would hear about it and threaten to stop praying for me if I didn't cut it out. But there was this very real desire to be near them, to understand them and to see them. And I do think that that's based in something, you know, more than personal eccentricity or something.
You write that you could almost feel a lingering presence there in the field where they had been that remained there much longer than the animal itself.
Absolutely. And the thing that I'm struck by after having spent a season in that place and among these bears is to have the bears on the landscape, to come close to them and to encounter them, it really changes the way you look at the world. I mean, for me, I felt that it sharpened my senses. And it gave me a sense of perspective, of some kind of understanding of a time when we existed in a world that exceeded our species.
And what about the people living around this farm? Did they worry about the fact that these animals were there? Did they kind of do things to stop them from coming into their space?
I think that's a really good point to raise. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit for us to pick in the landscape in terms of improving the way we coexist with these animals. So if somebody's leaving out hides, if somebody's leaving out unsecured garbage, or they have chickens that are not behind an electric fence, we know that those things are going to lead to dead bears. So there are a lot of these very practical things that we have to do as we look at this extremely important moment in the recovery of the species.
Millie had two cubs that she abandoned after she was injured so badly. They survived, but that's only because they were captured, brought into captivity, and eventually sent to the Baltimore Zoo.
Correct.
Are those cubs better off in captivity for the rest of their life, or would they be better off perishing like their mother did?
That's a very good question. I still don't know which would be better for the cubs, but I think I know what's better for us. I believe that to the extent that it's possible, any sort of emotional, individual, personal connection that we can forge between human beings in the modern world and animals like the grizzly is of vital importance. I know those cubs will not enjoy being in a zoo. It hurts me to see them there in spite of the fact that people are taking the best care possible of them. But what I hope is that people will form meaningful relationships with them, which will cause them to care about the species.
But you do have a tough task in front of you. I want to play part of an interview that I did in 2016 with a Wyoming rancher near Yellowstone. His name was Nick Patrick, and he'd been mauled by a female grizzly while working on his land.
And so the first thing she did was reach up and bite me in the face, you know, and then it was just a melee from there. And she at one point grabbed me by my left knee and dragged me about 20 feet and bit me through the hand, and then she finally decided she'd, I guess, taught me a lesson, and she took off.
Now, I play that, you know, not to be sensational, but because on the one hand, these are majestic animals who were living on this land long before we were. On the other, they do have this power to do a tremendous amount of damage, and it's your job to convince us, right, that both of these species can live together.
Yeah, I think it is my job to explore that relationship as deeply as I can and to look at it honestly, because I feel for him. I'm afraid of that outcome because I work in this landscape and with this species. I mean, that's a terror. I've had nightmares about it. At the same time, I want to highlight how infrequently that happens for the number of humans and bears that are on the landscape. And in the course of my encounter with bears, I felt a huge measure of fear. I've also felt extremely lucky and humbled. And I actually think that those three emotions are good things for human beings to be feeling, probably always, but certainly in our present moment.
Bryce Andrews, his new book is Down from the Mountain, The Life and Death of a Grizzly Bear. Bryce, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave. Control your comfort.
For the first time since the Boeing 737 MAX planes were grounded around the world, Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg faced shareholders and reporters at the company's annual shareholders meeting today in Chicago. The MAX planes have been grounded following two fatal crashes. We're joined now by Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And let's listen here to some of what Muilenburg had to say today about whether there was a design flaw in the MAX following a number of whistleblowers who voiced concerns about the airplane.
We haven't seen a technical slip or gap in terms of the fundamental design and certification of the approach. That said, we know this is a link in both accidents that we can break. That's a software update that we know how to do. We own it, and we will make that update. And this will make the airplane even safer going forward. And I'm confident with that change, it will be one of the safest airplanes ever to fly.
Jill, are people going to believe him that it's going to be one of the safest airplanes ever to fly?
Yeah, I think they got a ways to go. I mean, first of all, there, as I see it, four different constituencies. You know, we've got passengers. And remember, each of us now has the ability to go online and see which airplane our airline is actually flying, and we could choose different equipment. So we've got the passengers, we've got the pilots, and they were among some of the biggest worriers around some of these concerns. There are the regulators, and that might include lawmakers as well, and then shareholders. And I don't think they are there yet. I think there has to be a lot more proof to these findings by the company and seeing whether they play out with the regulators themselves.
Let's listen to a little bit more from the meeting. Here's a reporter pressing Muilenburg today.
You have stopped short of saying that there was a mistake made in the process. How do you win back trust when there are some that feel you have a real credibility issue when Boeing has not come out and said, you know, we didn't do this right?
Yeah, I think those are very fair questions again. And we've, again, probed on those same questions ourselves. We've gone back and looked at both accidents. We've done deep assessments of our airplane and the design, and we've confirmed that the MCAS system, as originally designed, did meet our design and safety analysis criteria and our certification criteria.
So, Jill, you talked about the four constituencies. I would add another, which you can hear there, which is people that might sue Boeing, and he doesn't want to admit too much because it could open them up to more lawsuits.
Yeah, and there are plenty of lawsuits that are already started. I think that there's going to be some real deep dive, and a lot of news outlets have done it already. We've done it at CBS News. You've done it at NPR. They're doing it at the New York Times. Is there a larger cultural issue at work here? We know that Boeing has expanded, and when they've gone into other markets like South Carolina, away from Seattle, have we had people trained as well? How is the company trying to balance three goals, some of which can be in conflict at the same time? That's safety, quality, but speed to get these planes out the door. And I think this is really going to be core to defense of some of those lawsuits.
And just remind us how important Boeing is to the U.S. economy.
Well, you know, it is pretty amazing because you think about aircraft sales as, you know, they're about $50 billion a year. We know that Boeing is almost half of that. We also know that Boeing is a member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Mm-hmm. Boeing's performance, however, I will say they've lost about 10% of the value since the March 10th crash. Boeing stock is still up 18% this year. Hmm. That's actually better than the Dow Jones Industrial Average at 13%.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Great to be with you.
A new report says that soil degradation caused by human activity is increasing climate change and affecting our ability to produce food. Degradation includes deforestation, overwatering, and chemical-intensive farming. The report was released today at a meeting of the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services in Paris. Soil has three times more carbon than the atmosphere, so damaging the soil causes more carbon to be released into the atmosphere, which speeds up climate change, leading to volatile weather that can make agricultural conditions even worse. One of the places where you can see that up close is in Guatemala, where many people have been fleeing in part because of climate change that has hurt farmers and led to more food insecurity. Tim Padgett of WLRN has our story.
Abraham is an indigenous farmer. That pow-pow he's describing is the sound of his hoe hitting dry earth back in his native Guatemala. After years of drought and erosion, the soil in the western Quiché highlands he calls home is hard as rock, and it no longer produces the crops his family needs to live. Corn, beans. When I was younger, we often had full harvests, says Abraham. Now, nothing. So in December, facing starvation, Abraham took his wife and two young boys on a two-week-long trek to the U.S. border. There they asked for asylum. After U.S. immigration officials processed them, they headed for Lake Worth in South Florida to join the large indigenous Guatemalan community here. Now they share a two-bedroom apartment with five other Guatemalan migrant families. A river used to run by my village, but it's gone, says Abraham, who asked us not to use his last name since his asylum case is pending. He adjusts the bracelet monitor U.S. officials put on his ankle and says, "Our pretty country is no longer there." At least not his corner of Guatemala, part of El Corredor Seco, the dry corridor. Scientists say climate change has been severely hostile to agriculture in that region. Last year, farmers there say they lost as much as 90% of their crops.
The number of Guatemalan families, new arrivals, are increasing. And I see the level of desperation, extreme poverty.
Amanda Escalante is a family aid coordinator at the nonprofit Guatemalan Maya Center in Lake Worth. She says the Guatemalans she's helping now are part of the world's new and growing cohort of displaced people, climate change refugees.
This is a reality. If there is not agriculture in Guatemala, how can they survive?
But how has climate change made Guatemala's Corredor Seco so much harsher? What distinguishes this from, say, a regular cycle of drought?
Volatility is really what affects farming systems.
Dan McQuillan is a Guatemala expert and agriculture programs manager for the nonprofit Catholic Relief Services. He spoke to me from Calgary, Canada. He says that climate change volatility is so damaging because it brings things like erratic bursts of hard rain even during drought. And that can kill crops not just for one harvest, but for years to come.
The soil is baked, hard as concrete, and the rain comes pouring down, battering the crop, and then just runs off. We're seeing a tremendous amount of erosion and loss of the productive topsoil.
For that reason, McQuillan thinks Trump's plan to cut off aid to Guatemala and other Central American countries will backfire.
It's just going to increase the pressures on these smallholder farmers to migrate.
But many in Washington are concerned that Central American governments don't use U.S. dollars effectively. Guatemala's environment minister, Alfonso Alonso, says he has a climate change relief program, yet he says he has no environmental experience. Guatemalan migrants say they saw little help from their government. Like Guillermina, who is 20. She asked us not to use her last name because her own asylum case is pending. She's an indigenous Guatemalan woman who arrived in Lake Worth, Florida, just a few weeks ago from Huehuetenango, part of the Corredor Seco. Shortly before Guillermina left for the U.S. border, her mother died of an illness made worse by malnutrition. Her mother also left a one-year-old baby boy. In her Maya dialect, Guillermina says she couldn't leave her baby brother Ronaldo behind.
I carried Ronaldo in my shawl the entire way. He got a fever and I was afraid he'd die, but I got him to the border and into a hospital.
Because Guillermina is not Ronaldo's mother, U.S. immigration officials couldn't let her bring him to Lake Worth. For now, he's in a crib in El Paso, Texas, one of the youngest climate change refugees in U.S. custody right now. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
The Goldman Environmental Foundation announced the winners of the 2019 Goldman Environmental Prize today, recognizing six grassroots environmental activists around the world. Jacqueline Evans is one of the winners. Her work led to the conservation and protection of the ocean around the Cook Islands. She joins us now on Skype. Jacqueline, welcome to Here and Now and congratulations.
Hi, thank you very much, Jeremy.
So the Cook Islands is made up of 15 small islands in the South Pacific. Tell us more about the marine life there, first of all.
We have a lot of beautiful marine life in the Cook Islands. We have humpback whales, marine turtles, a lot of rare seabirds and fish species, some endangered species. So, yeah, it's a beautiful place.
And what made you decide that it was going to be your mission to protect the ocean around the Cook Islands?
Oh, it concerns me a lot about, you know, with climate change and overfishing and pollution that's happening in our oceans around the world. So, you know, we wanted to do our bit. So that's why I got involved.
What kind of damage were you seeing?
Well, with climate change, we've seen our reefs beginning to bleach. That means that the corals turn white because of the stress that they're having from warmer sea surface temperatures. And we've also seen a decline in fish in our waters.
And you got the Goldman Prize now for grassroots activism. How did you manage to raise awareness and get people in the Cook Islands to care about protecting the reefs and the marine life?
Well, I've received this prize, but it was really actually teamwork. So I traveled all around the islands with our traditional leaders as well as some government representatives. And Kevin Edel, who is, he's a celebrity, a rugby league player, and had the idea of establishing this marine protected area.
And so what did you do to get people to care?
Well, it was really not hard to get the communities to care because they're so reliant on their resources. They live right next to the ocean. They get their food from the ocean. They live a subsistence lifestyle. And they really care about their natural resources.
So was there any pushback? Did the commercial fishing industry, for example, not want what you wanted?
Yeah, there was some pushback. But at the end of the day, the government listened to the communities. And, you know, it was basically the communities won the game.
Tell us a little bit about the marine conservation legislation called the Moray Moana Act. It was enacted by the Cook Islands government in 2017. What does it do to protect the oceans?
So the Benai Moana Act establishes protected areas around each of the 15 islands of the Cook Islands. So those protected areas extend from the beaches to 50 nautical miles around each island. And that's where we don't have any longline fishing or purse seine fishing, any large-scale commercial fishing, and also no seabed minerals activities are allowed in those areas. We protected 324,000 square kilometers of ocean through those 15 marine protected areas.
But you're still going to have to deal with the issue of climate change, right? Which there's not much you can do there in the Cook Islands to protect against. If the ocean warms and marine life suffers, that's going to be something that's going to be too big for one place to protect against, right?
That's right. So we suffer from the effects of climate change.
Howard University is at the center of a debate over gentrification that has resonated with people far beyond its campus in Washington, D.C. Howard has been one of the country's most prestigious black universities since 1867. But it's also in an area of Washington that, like the city as a whole, has been getting wealthier and wider. And now more people from the surrounding neighborhoods are using the campus like a local park, picnicking, jogging, and walking their dogs through a space that many students believe to be sacred. Kyra Azor is a senior journalism major who called out the dog walkers in the online publication The Griot. Kyra, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And what is it about people from outside Howard walking their dogs on the yard that you and so many other students find so disrespectful?
It's disrespectful mainly because you don't see it on other campuses. When you go to different places throughout the city, American, Georgetown, GW, you don't see people lounging around, laying out on blankets on, you know, their campus. But at Howard, that's something that people think is okay and think it's normal to do.
Well, town-gown relationships are tough at a lot of college campuses around the country. But here's how one white neighborhood resident named Sean Grubbs Robichaud responded to the situation at Howard, because people have been talking about this a lot lately, and he's speaking here with D.C.'s Fox 5 News.
They're in part of D.C., so they have to work within D.C. If they don't want to be within D.C., then move the campus.
So move the campus. Now, that made people at Howard very, very upset. It prompted the hashtag Howard Won't Move, and it really exemplifies the fact, doesn't it, that this is about a lot more than just walking a dog or going for a jog.
It does. To say that Howard, the most prestigious black institution in this country, should move because we don't want you to walk your dogs, to use our tracks to jog across our campus, it's disrespectful, because this is not a debate that we're having other places. Other people, other campuses don't have this issue. But you're telling us, a school that's been around for 152 years, that we should just move? Like, that's ridiculous. You just moved into this area.
Yeah. And can you explain why some people see this as an issue of race? You know, Howard, being a traditionally black university, was created, as one person pointed out on Twitter, because black people were not allowed in white spaces.
I think it's an issue of race, because a lot of students who go to Howard have come from predominantly white communities, predominantly white high schools, where they felt marginalized, stuffed into a box, that they had to act a certain way, behave a certain way to be accepted. Once they got to Howard, they were able to fully explore their identity. And so once you have people who come from outside of your community who you feel don't view you as you view yourself, we're in a country that has a lot of racial tension right now. So if you're in somewhere you don't feel safe, at a place where you pay to feel safe, then that's an issue.
So have you tried to speak with people who are using your campus as a park, walking their dogs or jogging, you know, stop them and explain to them why this is so offensive? Because they may not understand the full context and that what they're doing is offensive to you and others?
I have tried. Howard is a campus with a very rich history. So there are 9 historically black fraternities and sororities. Five of them were created at Howard. So we have lots of plots, lots of trees to honor these organizations. When I've seen people who aren't members of these organizations picnicking or laying out under the trees or sitting on the plots, I've tried to say, you know, this might not be the best thing. People find it disrespectful. And I've always been met with some sort of tension as to, you know, why would they find it disrespectful? You know, this is just a tree. This is just, it's public land. And it's really not public land. But even if it was, this is a tree that's, you know, specific to this organization for its members and not for people outside of their organization.
So what should be done? Would you like to see signs put up around the campus telling non-students to stay out or, you know, put up a gate, something like that?
I don't believe we should have to put up a gate, and I don't believe we should have to put up signs. I believe we should be able to express ourselves and communicate with community members that, you know, this isn't the right thing. This isn't what we want. We will all like to share this space, this community. We like to have community members come on. We like to host symposiums and things and interact and engage with the community. That's what Howard is known for. That's how we live out our university model of truth and service. We like to engage and serve the community and the surrounding population. But to do that, we have to be respected. So it's, I feel like it's a very simple request. Please don't use our school as a park, especially when there's a park across the street. There shouldn't be a reason why the track team can't host practice because they're community residents, you know, strolling along the track. Those are just things where you're now hindering the progress of the students and their education.
That's Kyra Azor, senior at Howard University. We'll link you to her piece in The Griot at hereandnow.org. Kyra, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.